Here is a question that sounds simple. I mean, almost like a grade school math problem. But apparently, it keeps some of the smartest people in finance and government up at night. If the government spends exactly $1, does the economy get back more than a dollar, exactly a dollar, or less than a dollar?
It's the whole debate over the fiscal multiplier. And honestly, it is like the holy grail of macroeconomics.
Right.
The answer to that question basically dictates whether a stimulus package is going to, you know, save an economy from a recession or just pile up a mountain of debt.
It feels like it should be basic accounting. You put money in.
You get growth out.
You get growth out.
Yeah.
But the sources you sent over for this deep dive suggest that depending on who you ask, and maybe more importantly, how they ask, the answer is just, well, it's all over the place.
Oh, completely. It ranges from, you know, this is going to save civilization to
it's a complete waste of money.
Or worse, that it actually shrinks the private sector.
Okay, but the really interesting part of this for me isn't just the answer itself. It's the methodology. It's how they try to find it.
Yeah.
Because as these papers point out, economists have this this massive handicap.
A lapless laboratory.
Exactly. You can't put the U.S. economy in a test tube. You can't just say, okay, for this experiment, let's crash the GDP by a 10% just to see what happens.
And then hit a reset button if it all goes wrong.
And you definitely can't do it twice to check your work.
Nope. And that is the fundamental problem we're tackling today, this identification challenge. How do you figure out cause and effect when you can't run a controlled experiment?
So we have two main groups of detectives in these sources.
That's right. You have the empirical strategists who are kind of looking for accidents in history, and then you have the quantitative modelers who try to build a simulation of the world from scratch.
Let's start with those detectives. I want to understand why this is so difficult in the first place. If I want to know if government spending works, why can't I just pull up a spreadsheet? You know, year one spending goes up, year two GDP goes up, done.
Because of a trap called endogeneity. It's a fancy word for the chicken and egg problem.
Okay.
Think about it. When does the government usually spend a massive amount of money?
Well, when there's a crisis. Recession, a pandemic.
A war. Exactly. So if you just look at the raw data, you see high spending correlated with a bad economy. And if you didn't know any better, you might actually conclude that the spending causes the bad economy.
Ah, it's like blaming ambulances for car crashes because you always see them at the same scene.
That is the perfect analogy. It really is. So to find the true multiplier, the real effect of that $1, we need something, an exogenous shock, something that happened to the economy, not because of it.
And looking at history, the cleanest, albeit grimmest, example of that is war.
Unfortunately, yes. Wars are the classic natural experiment. I mean, generally speaking, the U.S. doesn't decide to enter a conflict like World War II because its GDP dipped by a few points. It's a geopolitical decision. It comes from outside the economic system.
So if spending spikes because of a war and then the economy changes, we can be pretty sure the spending caused the change, not the other way around.
Exactly.
Now, the sources highlight the work of Valerie Ramey. She's a big name here. But she realized that even just looking at military spending data wasn't quite enough.
This is where it gets really clever. Ramey realized that by the time the government actually writes the check for, say, a new fleet of ships, the economy has already reacted to it.
Because people aren't stupid. They read the news. They know it's coming.
Precisely. Construction firms start hiring, steel prices move, the stock market reacts. It all happens on the news, not on the payment date. If you wait for the check to clear, you're looking at old information.
You're measuring the effect after it's already started.
Right.
So how does she get around that?
She went to the library. I mean, she literally read decades of Business Week in the New York Times. She built this massive data set based on when the news of the spending broke, not when the money was spent. She tracked expectations.
That is incredible dedication, parsing old headlines to build a math model.
It's amazing.
So when she does that, when she aligns the shock to the news cycle, what's the number? What's the multiplier?
When she includes World War II, which is, you know, the biggest shock in the data by far, she gets a multiplier of roughly 1.0.
Okay, so spend a dollar, get a dollar of GDP.
Basically a wash. But here's the kicker. If she takes World War II out of the data set,
what happens?
It drops to about 0.7.
Wow. That's not great. That implies for every dollar the government puts in, 30 cents of private activity just vanishes.
It does. It suggests some crowding out is happening. The government is using up resources, workers, materials, capital that the private sector would have used for something else.
But there is a counterargument in the data. We don't have to look at the whole country at once. Yeah. We can look at individual states.
Right. This is the Nakamura and Steinson approach. You're comparing California to, say, Illinois.
Because military spending isn't spread evenly, like peanut butter. It's
Oh.
chunky. One state gets a huge contract, another gets almost nothing. So you can treat the state that got nothing as a control group.
And that feels much closer to a real scientific experiment, doesn't it? You've got your treatment group and your control group all inside the same broader economy.
So when they do that, what do they find?
A much higher multiplier, around 1.5.
Whoa, 1.5 is a very different story from 0.7.
Totally different.
A multiplier of 1.5 is huge. If I'm a policymaker, that's a green light to spend whatever I want because I'm creating 50 cents of bonus value for every dollar. So why shouldn't we trust that 1.5 number more?
Because a state isn't a country. And this is a really crucial distinction that the texts make. California doesn't have its own central bank.
Meaning it can't print money or change interest rates.
Correct. If the entire U.S. economy overheats from too much spending, the Federal Reserve steps in and raises rates. That cools everything down and lowers the multiplier. But if just California overheats, well, the governor can't do anything about it.
And I'm guessing California doesn't have to pay the full tax bill for that military contract either.
Exactly. The federal government spreads that cost, that debt, across all 50 states. So California gets all the benefit, but it only pays a fraction of the cost. It's a kind of free lunch for them.
So the 1.5 number tells us that stimulus can work on a local level, but you can't just copy-paste that number to the national budget.
Precisely. It overstates the effect because it ignores those national consequences, like interest rates and the tax burden. So the real national number from the empirical detectives seems to be closer to Rami's 1.0, or maybe a little less.
Okay, so we've got war in states, but we can't always wait around for a war to measure things. The sources also mention a statistical tool for peacetime, something called a VAR, or vector autoregression.
Right. This is the second tool in the detective kit.
I've seen this term a million times, but walk me through it. What is a VAR actually doing?
Think of it as a kind of time machine that just looks for patterns. You feed it a timeline of data taxes, spending, GDP, and the math looks at all of history and says, okay, usually when spending went up yesterday, GDP went up today. It doesn't need a big event like a war. It just uses the whole flow of history.
But doesn't that take us right back to the ambulance problem? If two things move together, how does the VAR know which one caused the other?
It doesn't, not on its own. You have to give it a rule. You have to tell it what to think. We call this an identification assumption.
And the sources highlight a famous one from Blanchard and Parati. They use the sluggishness of government.
It's a brilliant insight. They just assumed that the legislative process is notoriously slow. So if GDP crashes today in this quarter, can Congress write a bill, pass it, and get it signed within 90 days?
No chance. It takes them 90 days to agree on lunch.
Exactly. So they assume that government spending is sticky in the short term. Therefore, if they see spending and GDP move together in the same quarter, they can assume the spending move must have been planned beforehand. It wasn't a reaction to what GDP did that quarter.
They use the inefficiency of bureaucracy as a scientific constant. I love that. And what number did they get?
Interestingly, they also landed right around 1.0.
So we're seeing a pattern here,
Right.
a convergence. The detectives, whether they're reading old newspapers or running statistical time machines, they all seem to circle around this spend a dollar, get a dollar result.
Mostly, yes, but the text raises a really important warning here about bias versus variance. It compares these methods to a shotgun versus a sniper rifle.
Yeah, I thought that was a great analogy.
So Ramey's method, the local projections, that's the shotgun. You don't make a lot of assumptions. You just blast the data against the news shocks. It's unbiased because you're not forcing a structure on it. But it's messy. The variance is high, your margin of error is wide.
And the VAR is a sniper rifle.
Yes. It produces a very tight, clean result, low variance. But to aim that rifle, you have to look through the scope, and that's your identification assumption. If your assumption is just slightly wrong, if that scope is bent, you miss the target completely. You get a precise answer that is totally wrong.
So you have to pick your poison, a blurry picture of the truth, or a really sharp picture of something that might be false.
That is the burden of the econometrician. You have to decide how much structure you're willing to impose on the world.
Okay, let's shift gears. We've been talking about looking backward at data, but the second half of this deep dive is all about the architects, the people who build structural models.
This is where we move from what happened to why it happened.
It sounds a bit like SimCity for economists.
That's a great way to put it. A structural model is basically a set of equations that describes a mini universe. you program a digital household, a digital firm, and a digital government, and you give them all rules to live by.
And the standard one mentioned in the text is the neoclassical model. So what are the rules for the little digital people in this simulation?
The main rule is that they're hyper-rational and forward-looking. They want to maximize their happiness, their utility. So they're always choosing between working, relaxing, and spending money. And they plan for the long term.
Okay, let's play this out. In the simulation, the government suddenly spends $1 billion. How do the digital citizens react?
This is where it gets kind of counterintuitive. In a neoclassical model, the citizens are smart. They see the government spending money, and they know the government has a budget. So if the government spends a dollar today, the citizen thinks, oh, they're going to have to tax me a dollar plus interest in the future to pay for this.
They feel the wealth effect. They feel poor because they know the bill is coming.
That's right.
So if I feel poor, I stop buying lattes and new shoes.
You consume less, yes. But you also do something else. Because you feel poor, you realize you can't afford as much time off. You need to replenish your savings for that future tax bill. So you actually work more.
Wait, so in the model, government spending makes people work harder?
In this model, yes. Labor supply goes up. But, and this is the big but, there's a second force called crowding out. The government is using up concrete and steel and engineers. That makes those things more expensive for private companies.
So private investment drops.
It plummets. The model predicts households consume less to save for taxes, and firms invest less because resources are more expensive.
Okay, so we have the theory, but a model is just algebra until you put real numbers in it. How do we know how much harder I work?
This is the art of calibration. We look for micro studies, studies of real individual behavior, to tune the settings of our digital citizens.
And the text points to a really fascinating source for this. Lottery winners.
I love this part.
It seems like the most random place to look for macro data. Why lottery winners?
Because it's a perfect natural experiment for that wealth effect. We need to know, when people get a bunch of money they didn't work for, do they become lazy? Do they quit their jobs?
So this study by Golosov and his colleagues, what did they find?
They looked at lottery winners, they tracked their earnings afterwards, and they found that for every $100 you win, your earned income drops by about $2.30.
That's surprisingly low. I mean, if I won the lottery, I feel like I'd just quit my job. But the data says most people just dial it back a tiny bit.
Exactly. It shows that labor supply is relatively inelastic. People kind of stick to their jobs. And the economists use this to calculate a parameter called the Frisch elasticity, which is basically the laziness factor. They set it to about 2.1 based on this data.
Okay, so we have a realistic number based on real human behavior. And now for the plot twist. What happens when we take that realistic, lottery-proven number and we plug it into the neoclassical SimCity?
The result is shocking. The model predicts a fiscal multiplier of, well, basically zero.
Zero.
Close to zero. The model says if the government spends a dollar, the private sector pulls back by almost exactly a dollar. The extra work people do, which isn't much because of the lottery data, is completely canceled out by the drop in private investment. The economy doesn't grow at all.
So we have this massive disconnect here. And this is the crux of the whole deep dive. The detectives, the data people, they say the multiplier is around 1.0. But the simulators, using the best theory and the best data, say the multiplier is zero.
This is the model validation crisis.
I mean, it sounds like a failure. We built this fancy model and it was just wrong.
But in science, a failure is a discovery. The fact that the neoclassical model predicts zero while reality says one tells us that the model is missing a gear. It forces us to ask, what did we leave out?
So what is the missing gear?
It strongly suggests that the wealth effect, that hyper-rational calculation about future taxes, isn't the main thing driving the economy. The missing link is likely the Keynesian channel.
The idea that demand creates its own supply.
Right. In a Keynesian view, if the government buys a tank, the factory workers get paid, they go buy dinner, the restaurant owner gets paid. That chain reaction of spending isn't really captured in the simple neoclassical model we described. That model assumes the economy is always constrained by supply, not demand.
So the zero result is actually useful. It proves that we can't explain the real world just by assuming everyone is a rational robot maximizing their savings.
Exactly. It helps validate that those Keynesian elements, frictions, sticky prices, demand constraints, are actually real. And this is why we need both approaches. The data detectives tell us what happens. The modelers help us figure out how it happens, or in this case, they reveal what our theories are getting wrong.
It's triangulation. You need the history to keep the theory honest, and you need the theory to understand the history.
Precisely. You can't just trust the data blindly because of heterogeneity, and you can't just trust the model blindly because it might be missing a crucial piece of reality.
So for you, the listener, trying to make sense of the next big economic debate, when a politician says, this bill will pay for itself with massive growth, or the opponent says, this will destroy the economy, where does the truth actually sit?
It sits in the messy middle. The evidence suggests stimulus does boost GDP, but it's not a magic wand. You get out roughly what you put in. It helps stabilize a crash, but it probably doesn't create infinite free value. The multiplier is likely somewhere around one.
It's a satisfyingly realistic answer. No magic, just mechanics.
Right.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave everyone with one final concept from the reading. It was about the invertibility of those VAR models.
Mm-hmm.
It felt almost philosophical.
Yes, the metaphysical question of economics.
The idea is that these statistical models assume that if they can't predict a change in the economy, it must be a shock, a surprise. But the source asks, does a spreadsheet ever really know the full state of the world?
It's a profound question to end on. We assume our model captures all the relevant information. But what if that surprise crash in GDP wasn't a shock at all? What if it was caused by something that everyone in the real world knew was coming, but it just wasn't a column in the Economist's data set?
Like a pandemic rumor or a political backroom deal or just a general vibe shift?
Exactly. Are there forecast surprises that are really just symptoms of our own blindness? It makes you wonder how much of the randomness we see in the economy is actually just data we haven't found a way to measure yet.
A very humbling thought for anyone trying to predict the future. Thanks for helping us break down the detective kit today.
My pleasure.
That's it for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.